Well, so far in this series, we've looked at three of the key episodes in the making of British democracy. We've looked at the Great Reform Act, at the Chartist Challenge, and at the coming of household suffrage. Today, we're going to look at the last great crisis of the reform era, the campaign for women's suffrage, and the coming of a universal franchise. Now, there is probably more high-quality scholarship on this aspect of reform than on any other part of this process. This is self-evidently not just a moment in Britain's political history or its constitutional history. It's also a crucial moment in gender history. It's about rethinking ideas of femininity and the appropriate roles that men and women can play in modern society. I'm going to be focusing today on the democratic implications of the suffrage and on its political rather than its social consequences. And I'll be trying to address three main themes. So firstly, I'll be looking at the building of the women's suffrage movement from the mid-19th century onwards. So we'll be looking at what it is that sparks that movement, what obstacles it faces, and the sorts of tactical dilemmas with which suffragists had to wrestle. Then I'll be looking at the opponents of women's suffrage, those men and women who fought to keep the vote in male hands. We like to assume, I think, that anti-suffragists were male dinosaurs, and for some of them that was certainly true. But their ranks also included some of the most educated, progressive, and politically active women of their day. So we have, I think, to try and understand how a progressive and emancipated woman could also be opposed to women's suffrage. Thirdly, I want to try and reintegrate women's suffrage with the history of male franchise. It's easy to forget that in 1914, about 40% of all adult men were still excluded from the franchise. So if 1918 begins the process of bringing women onto the electoral registers, it also completes the process of building a male franchise. And these are not wholly separate processes. They're constantly interacting with one another throughout that period. And we need, I think, to keep those two wings in mind. So we start with the origins of the movement. Now, if we're looking for the genesis of a substantial public debate about women's suffrage, the obvious place to look is probably 1867. This is the year that women's suffrage is first debated in Parliament, and the man responsible was John Stuart Mill, Britain's greatest philosopher. Mill moved an amendment to the Second Reform Act, proposing to give women the vote on the same terms as men. And Mill was by far the most prestigious man who had ever supported women's suffrage. Nonetheless, even with Mill's support, it has to be said that this is treated as a bit of a joke. So one MP told the House of Commons, "I look upon the question at issue as a pleasant interlude in the grave discussions in which this House is engaged." There's another MP who actually makes it sound like he's never really met a woman before. He said, "He had taken some trouble to ascertain the opinions of ladies on this subject. And a short time ago, being introduced to two ladies, he asked them what they would do with a vote if they had one. They replied that they would vote for the candidate who would give them the best pair of diamond earrings." Much laughter in brackets. If we look at the leading newspaper of the day, The Times, it was astonished that such a clever man had taken up such a silly cause. It said, "Ever since the world has existed, the great mass of women have been of weaker mental power than men, with an instinctive tendency to submit themselves to the control of the stronger sex. Their destiny is marriage, their function is maternity, their sphere is domestic." Mill was defeated by 196 votes to 73. And what I think is really telling about that statistic is the fact that more than 400 MPs hadn't even bothered to vote. This simply wasn't seen as a major issue. Now, when Mill first announced his motion, the newspapers reported a general laugh in which the ladies in the gallery heartily joined. And as this suggests, one of the key arguments against women's suffrage at this stage was the idea that women themselves were opposed to it, that women didn't want the vote. So if we take someone like Gladstone, in so many ways the great reformer of the Victorian era, Gladstone told the House of Commons, "There has never within my knowledge been a case in which the franchise has been extended to a large body of persons who are generally indifferent about receiving it. And Gladstone laid down a challenge for the suffragists. Prove that women really wanted the vote. And it's to meet that challenge that the first suffrage societies are founded in 1867. Now, we might, of course, ask why there was so little agitation before that point, given what an important theme reform and the franchise had been in British politics. Well, if you're going to get the suffrage movement going, if you're going to draw women onto the streets demanding the right to vote, then you need, I think, to have three things. First, you need a sense that women are specifically excluded simply for being women, that there is a common identity between women as non-electors. Second, you need a sense that politics matters in everyday life, that not having a vote is a substantial disadvantage. And thirdly, you need a conviction of the centrality of the vote to political life, a sense that if you want to wield political influence, the vote is the means by which you do that. And for much of the 19th century, I think none of those things obviously apply. So until the Second Reform Act in 1867, the vast majority of British men are also excluded from the franchise. So to be a non-elector was simply the common experience of men and women alike. The vote itself was traditionally understood, and I talked about this in a previous lecture, as a family possession. You have a family vote in the sense that you might have a family car or a family home later on. It was, of course, the man who actually cast the vote. In all probability, it was the man who chose which candidate to vote for. But a woman whose husband or father was an elector could, in this period, still think of herself as having a vote. And voting, of course, is only one way of being politically active, and I think that's especially true when you're dealing with a small electorate. So pressure groups like the Anti-Slavery Societies or the Anti-Corn Law League all had substantial female memberships. From at least the 1860s onwards, the main political parties were all building female support bases. So the two main liberal organisations, the Women's Liberal Federation and the Women's National Liberal Association, had about 150,000 members by the First World War. If we take the Primrose League, attached to the Conservative Party, by 1914, it had at least 500,000 female members engaged in campaigning, canvassing, and political discussion. And from the 1870s onwards, there are substantial opportunities opening up in local government. Women could vote in most local elections. They could also run as candidates. And it is, of course, a time when the vast majority of what we now think of as domestic policy issues are handled at a local level. So schools, hospitals, workhouses, housing policy, these are all areas in the late 19th century in which women can have substantial influence. Now, local government was seen as particularly appropriate to women, precisely because of the sort of areas that it focused on. So things like education, sickness, poor relief, these were all seen as extensions of the home. These are essentially nurturing activities. So the argument goes that they are peculiarly suited to a woman's gifts. And in this sense, what we're getting in the late 19th century is a reworking of the ideology of separate spheres. The idea that there is a domestic sphere appropriate to woman and a public sphere appropriate to man. And part of the reason I think why this is such a durable idea is that it's a very fluid concept. So instead of just confining women to the household, what we're seeing in this period is a carving out of a certain area of public policy as an extension of the home. So there are, I think, good reasons why it's very difficult to mobilise a women's suffrage movement. Nonetheless, by the time we get to the final quarter of the 19th century, I think all of these things are starting to erode. In the first instance, there has, of course, been an explosion in the male electorate. That makes the total exclusion of women much more visible. The more that Parliament dismantles the obstacles in the way of male enfranchisement, the more it marks out the gender divide as an anomaly. And this becomes a theme of suffrage propaganda, the idea that women are insulted by their exclusion from the franchise. So this was a particularly popular poster from the period. What a woman may be and yet not have the vote. She can be a mayor, a nurse, a mother, a doctor, a teacher, a factory hand. Simply by virtue of being a woman, she is excluded. A man, on the other hand, can be a convict, a lunatic, a proprietor of white slaves, unfit for service, or a drunkard, but still, by virtue of his sex, qualify for the franchise. Over here we have another poster on the same theme, the idea that there are now three categories of non-electors: convicts, lunatics, and women. So we have this image of the educated woman locked in a cage together with the prisoner and the mentally ill. Secondly, once you start to expand the electorate, I think the vote becomes much more obviously the way in which you exert political influence. If you look at the really successful pressure groups at the end of the 19th century, they tend to be groups that have an electoral power base. So the Home Rule movement generates the Irish Party. The trade union movement generates the Labour Party. They gain concessions through their influence within Parliament. Now, women can still be active as supporters of those movements, but it's becoming, I think, much harder for them to exert influence on Parliament directly on what we might think of as women's concerns. Finally, the distinction between local and national government, so pivotal to separate spheres ideology, is, I think, starting to break down. And so is the idea that you can take things like empire and foreign policy and taxation and put them in a different category to things like welfare. And that's, I think, quite nicely illustrated by the Second Boer War in 1899. At the start of the war, thousands of people in Britain volunteered to fight. They turned up at recruiting stations, only for one in three of them to fail the army medical. In some of the great towns of the north, in some of the inner cities, the proportion of recruits failing the army medical was 60 or even 70%. Now, you can't be an imperial power if your population are all keeling over with tuberculosis. So this starts to blur that divide between imperial policy and domestic policy. So if we look at the statute book over the Edwardian period, Parliament is legislating on things like free school meals, children's health, unemployment, housing. We start to see the beginnings of the modern welfare state. Famously, of course, in 1903, Joe Chamberlain launches the Tariff Reform Campaign. This is an attempt to abandon free trade and to put import duties on foreign goods. So suddenly, the biggest issue in national politics is the price of food. It's the household shopping bill. And strikingly, a lot of the propaganda in the battle that follows is targeted explicitly at women, as the people who do the household shopping and who manage the household budget. Now, these aren't just areas that affect women. They're areas on which women are the acknowledged experts. And that, too, is something that suffragists play up in propaganda. So I don't know how well you can see this poster, but here we have John Bull being deafened by all these appalling new political issues that are breaking out, like temperance reform, the infant death rate, poor law reform, factory legislation, the cry of the children. You know, poor old John Bull, he does war. He doesn't really get these sorts of issues. So we have the suffragists, the experts on domestic policy, saying, "Won't you let me help you, John?" That's a theme of a lot of suffrage literature. So by the start of the 20th century, I think we can say that a political space has opened up for a new women's suffrage movement. And there are two key organisations in play. We have the National Union of Women's Suffrage Societies, which is created in 1897. And then from 1903, a breakaway group, the Women's Social and Political Union. You'll notice, incidentally, that they both use very much the same colour scheme. And these colours of green, white, and either purple or red come up again and again in suffrage literature. It becomes a way of sort of banding suffrage propaganda. Now, the NUWSS was a federation of different suffrage societies, which is why they use the tree as their theme, with unifying branches across the country. Broadly speaking, this is a peaceful and constitutional organisation. Its members are known as suffragists. The WSPU, on the other hand, is founded by the Pankhursts. It's more inclined to militancy, and members of the WSPU are generally known as suffragettes to distinguish themselves from the National Union. And I'm going to say more about the suffragettes later on. I want to kick off by talking about the moderates and the National Union. And the dominant figure in the National Union was this lady, Millicent Garrett Fawcett. Now, Fawcett was a genuinely remarkable woman. She wrote two novels. She wrote several books on economics, including a beginner's guide to political economy, or I think actually it's called Political Economy for Beginners, that was used in British schools into the 1950s. She founded Newnham Hall in Cambridge. She fought for the repeal of the Contagious Diseases Act. But the suffrage movement really becomes her great crusade from the 1890s onwards. And the National Union has really two primary goals. The first is educational. So at a time when this is a new and rather radical idea, the first task is simply to build up a support base for women's suffrage. So we get magazines like The Common Cause, publications like the ABC of Women's Suffrage, designed to lay out the arguments for change in a clear and accessible fashion. And they try to give practical examples of why women need the vote. So, for example, in a pit village, milk is hard to get and difficult to keep sweet, so babies and invalids suffer. Fruit and vegetables are also hard to get, as there are few gardens or allotments. With a vote, the woman could improve the Small Holdings Act and make its application much less cumbrous and difficult. And it's interesting, I think, that so much of this literature takes very working class concerns, very everyday practical concerns, because one of the allegations they're having to fight off is that this is essentially about posh women in hats who just want to play at being politicians. They have to prove that this is a popular and working class issue. Now, like Chartism, the suffrage movement was very much a visual phenomenon. We have suffrage uniforms, suffrage colours and parades. It's also quite a vocal movement in more ways than one. Suffragists were very good at writing songs. The most famous, which becomes an anthem for the suffrage movement, is called The March of the Women. And it's written by one of the famous composers of the day, Dame Ethel Smyth. Now, Ethel Smyth was actually later imprisoned for suffragette violence, and the conductor Sir Thomas Beecham went to visit her in prison. And he recorded this extraordinary scene when he walked into the prison, where all the prisoners were lined up in the exercise yard, singing the March of the Women, while Smyth was leaning out of the windows of her cell, conducting them with her toothbrush. I was hoping to be able to play you a clip of this file. I couldn't get that to work, but you can find it on the internet. It's quite a remarkable noise. And if you look at the words, and if you get to listen to the music later on, I think you can see very clearly what the model for this kind of song is. It's very clearly based on a hymn. It's recognisable as the kind of thing that you would sing in church at the time, and we do have some religious language in there. Now, women, of course, were much more likely in this period than men to go to church, and religion is a very important battlefield in suffrage debates. So anti-suffragists tend to quote St. Paul on the subject and his decree that women should not speak in church and that women should not take positions of leadership within the church. Suffragists, on the other hand, tended to argue that female voters would Christianise the state. They would reconnect it with Christian public opinion. So we get a lot of images like this one on the left of sort of the suffrage in a crucifix position, projecting the moral appeal of the suffrage. And there are also organisations like this, the Church League for Women's Suffrage. And suffragists work extremely hard to build a support base within the churches. So the Church Suffrage League has five bishops on its books by the First World War. Its president is the Bishop of Lincoln. And that's an important way, I think, of neutering some of the charges against women's suffrage. So if the first task of the suffrage movement was to try and mould public opinion, the second is, of course, to project it onto government. As I said before, one of the most common arguments against suffragism was that women did not want the vote. So the suffragists have to convince MPs that that is a misapprehension, that there is a serious, durable and deep-rooted demand for an extension of the franchise. Now, the difficulties in the way of doing this were, I think, substantial. By definition, the suffrage movement is trying to create a political organisation out of the least politically powerful people in the country. Working women in particular found it very hard to make the time to campaign. As the slogan goes at the time, a husband works from sun to sun, a woman's work is never done. Even middle-class women often needed the permission of their husbands to take part in suffrage activity. And that meant that reaching out to male support is also an important part of what these societies have to do. And the idea that suffragists are not proper women, that they're neglecting their wives and their families, is a theme of anti-suffrage literature. So here we have a suffragette's home, you know, the poor old working man coming back to find, you know, the washing hasn't been done, the kids are crying, you know, his dinner's in the dog, and, you know, home's going to pot. And that, you know, idea that, you know, suffragism was about tearing up the family and destroying marriage is one of the great obstacles in the way of the suffrage movement. And just as importantly, suffragists face a series of tactical dilemmas. The first is how far they should stress the practical advantages of the vote or the political differences that might emerge between male and female electors. If they suggest that women have specific grievances to settle, that they'll use the vote to reorder the marriage laws or to reorder gender relations, they'll be accused of this kind of thing, of breaking up marriage and of damaging the family. On the other hand, of course, if they play down the idea that women have special interests, they're vulnerable to the argument that there is no actual need to extend the franchise, that they can perfectly well be represented by their husbands. So that's one dilemma that the suffragists are constantly working around. A second dilemma is how far they should go outside the existing party system. So by 1912, the National Union has lost patience with the Liberal government, and it urges all of its members to work against Liberal candidates at elections, to oppose the re-election of Liberal MPs, until and unless the Liberals propose a government women's suffrage bill. The problem, of course, is that politically interested women were never just suffragists. They were, you know, by definition of being politically interested, also passionate about home rule, or free trade, or labour reform, or all of the other issues convulsing politics at the time. So there are difficult decisions to be made here about the extent to which you prioritise your support for suffrage in a tight contest between a conservative and a liberal. The third and probably most important dilemma is what to do when constitutional methods fail. And this brings us to the question of militancy and the Women's Social and Political Union. So the WSPU is founded by the Pankhursts. We have Emmeline Pankhurst at the top here, with her daughters Christabel and Sylvia. Now, the Pankhursts were extraordinary publicists. They specialised in the kind of display that captivates media attention. And it was supported by some extremely wealthy people. If you look at their list of major donors, it's like reading Debrett's or Burke's Peerage or something. You've got Lady Brassey, Lady Parsons, Princess Sophia Duleep Singh, the Countess de Loire, Lady Berkeley, Lady Wolseley, and so on and so on. If you look at the suffrage press and you look at the kind of shops that advertise in the back, you've got all of the most fashionable boutiques and clothes shops in London. You've got Burberry's, Swan and Edgar, Debenhams, these kinds of shops. By 1914, the Pankhursts are generating an annual income of about £47,000 a year. £47,000 a year. Now, to put that in perspective, the income of the Labour Party in 1908 is about £10,000. So this is a serious financial force. And it uses that money to stage spectacular events. This is a set of photographs from Coronation Day in 1911. The suffragettes brought about 40,000 women to London to take part in a special coronation march. And they were divided into national and regional groupings and dressed appropriately. So over here, not particularly clear, on the top left you can see a group of English suffragettes with their white smocks, bonnets and aprons. Underneath we have Welsh suffragettes, wearing traditional, what was believed to be traditional, Welsh costume. The top right there, we've got a cohort of Indian suffragettes, some of whom have come over especially for this. And of course, the coronation is a great imperial occasion. So this is a way of projecting suffragism too as an imperial force, uniting progressive women around the British Empire. There are also WSPU shops created around the country, which act as sort of nodes for organising the suffrage movement. Now, the Pankhursts were tired of all the excuses. So in place of the constitutional methods of the National Union, they become associated with militancy. Now, militancy is a sort of catch-all phrase that actually covers quite a range of different activities. In the early years of the movement, it might mean heckling at a public meeting. And of course, the sight of women speaking in public, not just speaking, but interrupting the Prime Minister, is quite a shocking sight early on. And these are partly acts of political theatre. So the sight of women being dragged out of meetings by policemen is partly about projecting a message to other women, saying that this is a state that rests upon political violence. And it's also about challenging and transgressing gender norms. The suffragettes tended to wear clothes that emphasised their femininity, which is why they're called suffragettes. So by putting on their best frocks and then lugging a brick through a window, this is partly a way of challenging what it actually means to be a woman, what femininity is really about. One of the problems with militancy, though, is that you have to keep ratcheting up the level of outrage. So heckling a politician will get you on the front page once. Next time, you're going to have to go further. The time after that, you're going to have to go further again. G.K. Chesterton once said, I'm not putting the suffragettes on the front page of my newspaper for anything less than a full-blown massacre. So there's a kind of, you know, impulse here to keep doing something more and more spectacular. So we see a ratcheting level of violence. We get acid in letterboxes, changing the points on railway lines, letter bombs to politicians. And in 1913, there's a wave of arson attacks. So top left here, we have the ruins of St. Catherine's Church at Hatcham, torched by suffragettes. On the top right here, under that remarkable headline, "More Arson by Wild Women," this is after an attack by a sort of suffragette fighting force on Bristol University. They burnt down a new athletics complex built 2 years earlier. Over here, we have Yarmouth Pier in flames. And on the bottom right, we've got Levitt Lee, which was the country home of a Conservative MP. Now, the Pankhurst slogan was "deeds, not words." They presented the suffrage movement in apocalyptic terms. So here we have a typical image from the front of the suffragette newspaper, the forces of evil denouncing the bearers of light. And the ambitions of the suffragettes went beyond simply securing the franchise. In 1913, Christabel Pankhurst published a series of articles called "The Great Scourge" and "How to End It." This was a series of articles on sexually transmitted disease. She claims that 80% of all British men had a sexually transmitted disease, which they had picked up from using prostitutes and were now inflicting upon their wives. So her solution, which becomes a sort of slogan for a certain set of suffragettes, is "Votes for Women and Chastity for Men." So this is a challenge to sexual morality as well as to the distribution of political power. Now, historians, I think, are very divided still on the effect of militancy. On the one hand, the Pankhursts are superb at attracting attention. They do put women's suffrage on the front page of the papers. And this is a time, of course, when suffragism is fighting for political space. If you've studied the Edwardian period, you'll know that this is not a time which is short of major crises. This is the decade of the tariff reform campaign, the House of Lords crisis, an extraordinary wave of trade union militancy. It's also, of course, the period of the Home Rule crisis in Ulster. So it's a time when election posters look like this. "Every vote for a Liberal is a vote for civil war." When the Conservative Party is telling its supporters in 1914, "Britain may soon be stained with the blood of civil war. No method remains except armed revolt by which the country can make its will prevail." So simply to get a hearing for suffragism is an important achievement. In 1913, at Ascot, this happened. A suffragette called Emily Davison ran out of the crowd and fell under the king's horse. She died shortly afterwards of her injuries. Now, that picture is shown on newspapers all around the world, and it becomes a symbol of the sacrifices that have been made for this movement. So Davison appears in the suffragette newspaper as an angel, representing the love that conquers all. And there's no doubt that figures like Davison and the Pankhursts become extraordinary inspirations for many women at the time. Many suffragettes, of course, are imprisoned for acts of violence, where many of them go on hunger strike. And images of women being force-fed in prison, I think, do tremendous damage to the Liberal government. These are deeply uncomfortable images if you are a Liberal supporter. You know, whatever you think of militancy as a Liberal, there's something very uncomfortable about the idea that women are being tortured in prison for demanding something you probably think they ought to have anyway. On the negative side, the sheer violence of militancy does also alienate support. So quite a lot of people who have previously favoured women's suffrage turn against the movement at the peaks of militant activity. Churchill and Lloyd George would be two prominent examples. One of the dangers of militancy, of course, is that it simply provokes counter-violence. So after suffragettes attacked Bristol University, the students simply struck back and burnt down the local suffrage headquarters. Militancy also potentially plays to some of the negative stereotypes about women that suffragists were trying to overcome. The idea that women are hysterical, that they can't control their emotions, and that they're simply impervious to the appeal of reason. And if you look at cartoons on suffragism towards the end of the Edwardian period, I think you see an increasingly derisory note. So here from Punch, we have the suffragettes that knew jiu-jitsu, tossing policemen over the railings. In an American newspaper, but they are reproduced in Britain, we get a series of what are called ruthless rhymes for martial militants. For example, Mary had a little bomb, its fuse was trimmed and lighted, and everywhere that Mary went, the people fled affrighted. And contempt is something I think very dangerous to a political movement. Having said all that, though, I think we can see an interesting synergy at work between militant and non-militant suffragists. By 1914, the WSPU is in crisis. It's hemorrhaging members, it's losing donations. The non-militant suffrage societies, on the other hand, are booming. So the membership of the NUWSS goes up from 8,000 in 1908 to 55,000 in 1914. And I think militancy and the prominence it gives to the suffrage question does have to take some credit for this. You know, however unpopular militancy might have been, it does force people to think about the suffrage issue and to take sides one way or the other. It would be wrong, of course, to suggest that all women were converted to suffragism in this period. Curiously, the strongest and most vocal opposition to women's suffrage in the decade or so immediately before 1914 comes not from men, but from women, a group of determined female anti-suffragists. The female anti-suffrage societies had nearly 50,000 members by 1914. That's 50,000 women subscribing to organisations, the purpose of which is to stop women voting. So there's a paradox here that I think we have to address. When we think about anti-suffragists, as I suggested earlier, I think we tend to assume that they're male bigots. And in some cases, that's certainly true. So in 1912, a man called Sir Almroth Wright wrote a famous letter to the Times in which he blamed suffragism on, inevitably, sexual frustration. He said, "The recruiting ground for the militant suffragettes is the 500,000 of an excess female population, a class of women who have all their lives been strangers to joy. Women in whom instincts long suppressed have in the end broken into flame. These are the sexually embittered women, etc., etc., etc." And on it goes. Now, Wright was actually a very eminent man. He was a scientist. He was one of the pioneers of vaccination therapy, vaccination treatment. He's decorated by governments across Europe. Nonetheless, I think the damage done by this kind of thing is actually quite limited. It's so obviously sexist that even other antis denounce it. The suffrage societies actually simply reprint Wright's letter and publish it as a suffrage pamphlet, as a way of saying to women, look, this is the kind of thing that you're up against. Female anti-suffragists, I think, pose a much bigger challenge, especially as the women who led the anti-suffrage movements were educated, intelligent, and politically active. So let's take some examples. The most prominent anti of the period was Mrs. Humphrey Ward. Now, Ward was one of the best-selling novelists of the century, and in many respects she was a feminist. She believed passionately in women's education. Do we have anybody here from Somerville? Alas. Well, Mrs. Humphrey Ward is one of the founders of Somerville College in Oxford, so that women can have access to the best education. She worked as hard as anyone to get women involved in local government. She helped set up a local government association to bring women in to local politics. Another leading anti, I couldn't find a photograph, was called Elizabeth Burgoyne. Mrs. Burgoyne was one of the most celebrated educational specialists of her day. She was probably the leading expert of her time on what we now call special needs education. She testified before parliamentary committees. She advised ministers and MPs. She served for a couple of years in the Ministry of Labour. Over here we have Violet Markham, obviously a photo taken much later in life. Markham was a fervent imperialist who was hugely involved in both charitable and colonial work. Unusually for the time, she kept her maiden name when she got married. Markham was her maiden name, not her husband's name. So again, here we have a woman who is in many respects very progressive, organising against women's suffrage. Now, for some of them, this is an argument not about gender as such, but about the state and what the state should and should not do. Many of them were essentially small state thinkers. They didn't want the state intruding further into domestic policy, and they worried that government would become more active in these areas once it had the votes of wives and mothers. Essentially, as long as Parliament was exclusively male, it was argued, it would lack the moral authority to push too far into the home. So limiting the franchise to men becomes a way of shrinking the size of the state. And that, of course, taps into a broader anti-politics mood, which may indeed be stronger among women in this period than it is among men. For others, like Mrs. Humphrey Ward, it's about something deeper. It's about the nature of politics itself and the way in which women exert political influence. I should explain, by the way, that Humphrey is not actually her name. Humphrey Ward was her husband, so she's known as Mrs. Humphrey Ward as a result. Now, Ward argued that policy making, which is what she was interested in, had nothing whatsoever to do with the vote. Giving the vote to men, she argued, was a form of social control. It's a way of channeling their political grievances without having to resort to physical violence. Policy, by contrast, she argued, was made by elites. It's made by royal commissions, elite newspapers, and other intellectual fora. And in that world, she insisted, men and women are equal. Now, the argument here wasn't simply that women didn't need the vote. It was that enfranchising women might actually weaken their ability to influence public policy. It's no coincidence, I think, all of these are quite prominent and well-connected women. Because if you had good contacts in this period and you wanted to influence policy, there were some advantages to not having a vote. As non-electors, women were intrinsically above party. A woman like Violet Markham or Elizabeth Burgoyne could work equally well with liberals or conservatives. She can breakfast with Lloyd George and lunch with Arthur Balfour. And one of the striking features of this period, I think, is the sheer number of women who are appointed to royal commissions. And the reason for that is that they're appointed as independent experts. They're there to represent expertise and to balance the party hacks put on there by the liberals and the conservatives. Now, once the women's suffrage campaign got going, and especially once militancy begins to boil, women found that position under threat. So Mrs. Bergwin tells a demonstration in 1908, "If we sign the petitions and let the men know how we feel about the matter, I feel certain we shall be restored. I say restored because I have known and experienced that I am not treated in the same serious manner today that I was 2 years ago." So there's a sense among these women that their political influence is ebbing because of the suffrage movement. Now, those petitions are remarkably successful. The antis actually produce more petitions with more women's signatures than the suffragists do. Nonetheless, they are, I think, running out of steam by 1914. There are increasingly embarrassing differences opening up between male and female antis. And the argument that policymaking has nothing to do with the franchise, I think, is just becoming increasingly hard to sustain, especially when you can look at Parliament and you can see the legislative concessions being given to trade unions and to Irish nationalists. As I said earlier, that dividing line between imperial policy and domestic policy was getting more and more amorphous. So what we see from anti-suffragists by 1914 is, I think, a series of increasingly bizarre and desperate proposals, like the idea of a separate women's parliament elected by women that would be a kind of advisory council to the real parliament. So despite all these problems, the suffrage movement is visibly making progress. By 1914, the National Union has about 55,000 fee-paying members. It's got about 40,000 more associate members. It's gone from 15 branches in 1897 to more than 500 at the start of the war. They're also making progress within Parliament. By 1900, every major party in the House of Commons has voted in principle for women's suffrage. Some of the most powerful men in British politics are public converts to suffragism. Andrew Bonar, for instance, future Conservative leader, was the vice president of his local suffrage society. When the Liberals won the election in 1906, the Prime Minister received a suffrage deputation at Downing Street. He told them, "You have made your case." And this comes together, I think, in 1908, when a suffrage movement passes the House of Commons by a landslide, 273 votes to just 94. So all of that begs the question of why nothing actually happens until 1918. Now, this takes us, I think, to the heart of the suffrage problem, and it's something that came up last week in relation to the Second Reform Act. The real question for MPs after 1900, I think, is not really whether women should have the vote. It's which women and under what conditions. Given, of course, that even men don't have universal suffrage in this period, it's only really going to be some women who are brought onto the electoral register. And which ones you choose can shape the political landscape for a generation. There are, of course, various possibilities. One is simply to leave the electoral system exactly as it stands, but to take away the gender bar, to take the words "male person" in the statute and change them to "man" or "woman." The problem with that is that it wouldn't enfranchise very many people. The main qualification to vote before 1914 was still the rating franchise. You had to pay the rates or local taxes on your household or apartment. And rates are paid by the head of the household. And in this period, of course, that inevitably means the man. So if you extend the rating franchise to women, you're only really going to bring in two groups. You're going to bring in single women, unmarried women who have set up household on their own, and very wealthy women, couples that are rich enough to have a second property in the name of the wife. Now, both parties, I think, are quite uncomfortable with this, though for rather different reasons. Conservatives, as we know, are very keen on marriage. They're worried that enfranchising single women is going to penalise marriage. It'll be a disincentive to women getting married. As one MP puts it, it would reward the woman who has failed in the role of her own sex. Liberal agents, on the other hand, liberals had a different set of anxieties. They thought that by bringing in more wealthy women, they would tip the balance of the electorate towards the Conservative Party. So Lloyd George, who supports women's suffrage in principle, warns that simply extending the franchise as it stands to women will add hundreds of thousands of votes to the strength of the Tory party. And remember, this is a time when the balance of forces between the two parties is extremely evenly poised. The general election in December 1910 produces an extraordinary result. We've got liberals and conservatives with exactly the same number of seats. So any slight change in the balance of the electorate, however small, is potentially going to dictate the course of politics for the next decade or more. On the other hand, if you give votes to married women, you're going to have to change the whole basis of the franchise. If you're going to let women vote without a property requirement, then realistically you're probably going to have to let men do so as well. And that opens up the possibility of a much more democratic change, potentially opening the way to universal male suffrage. This is where the issue of male suffrage, I think, becomes so important. As I said earlier, 40% of adult men are still excluded from the electoral system in 1914. There's not a great deal of pressure to change this. There isn't a great male suffrage movement that we've all been ignoring. But any alteration to women's suffrage rights is going to have consequences for those men. It's either going to shut them out for even longer, because reform bills don't come on very often, or it's going to open the way to a new male enfranchisement. So where you stand on women's suffrage in this period does depend very much on how you feel about male suffrage. The Labour Party, again, despite its alliance with the National Union, is very uncomfortable about a women's suffrage bill that will not bring in more male electors, because they think that will simply delay an increase in the working class male vote. So by 1914, there's a bit of a parliamentary stalemate developing. There are various suffrage bills brought forward, often described as conciliation bills. But there's nothing on which Parliament can actually agree. And given that you've got a House of Commons controlled by the Liberals and a House of Lords controlled by the Conservatives, you really do need some measure of cross-party agreement if you're going to get a suffrage bill through. And the issue is still stuck in that position when war breaks out in 1914. So that brings us to the impact of the war on the suffrage question. Now, it's sometimes suggested that women earn the vote by their wartime service. And it is, of course, true that thousands of women take up new jobs in industry during the war years, famously in the munitions factories. In this respect, women can claim to have contributed to the war effort in 1918 in much the same way as men. That's an argument that the WSPU in particular likes to put forward. But there are, I think, reasons to be wary of this argument. Firstly, the women enfranchised in 1918 are predominantly older women. The qualification is that you must be over the age of 30 and either a ratepayer or married to a ratepayer. Most of the war workers were much younger, and they have to wait for the franchise. In some respects, you could argue, I think, that the First World War actually reinforces certain gender stereotypes. The argument that men might ultimately have to go and die for their country is actually much more plausible in 1918 than it was in 1912, after 2 to 3 years of compulsory military service. So if we want to pin down the influence of the war, I think we have to be a little bit more precise. On one level, I think the war gives politicians an excuse to climb down. Politicians who even before the war have been looking for grounds to change their position on women's suffrage, now have an argument that they can deploy to do so. That's important for someone like Asquith in particular. The war also advances the domestication of politics. So one of the unintended consequences of the war is an extraordinary expansion in the size of the state. You've got Parliament involved in things like food distribution, rationing, working conditions, medical care. So the kind of politics that many of the antis have been fighting for has simply disappeared forever. But the most important contribution of the war, I think, is that it resolves the issue of male suffrage. By 1918, the electoral register is practically defunct. You've had so many men moving around, so many men moving across to France to fight in the war, that there simply is no longer a viable electoral register. You have to reopen the reform question before you can hold a new election. The Conservatives in particular are now very keen to enfranchise the soldiers. And that lowers the opposition to universal male suffrage. And once you've got universal male suffrage, I think a lot of the difficulties associated with women's suffrage are simply resolved. It makes the idea of a limited female enfranchisement much more appealing. So if you enfranchise older women and ratepayers and propertied women, then you can sell that as a sort of conservative with a small c ballast against this torrent of new male electors. And what's striking, I think, about the 1918 Representation of the People Act is the nature of the restriction that it imposes. It's essentially an age barrier. It shuts out women under the age of 30. Now, on one level, of course, that plays to a set of long-standing gender stereotypes. The idea that women are childish and giddy, that they only really reach maturity when they marry and have children. But it also, I think, reminds us of an important point about the electoral system that preceded the Fourth Reform Act. I've said several times in this lecture that 40% of adult men were excluded from the franchise before 1918. But what's important, I think, is they were not necessarily the same men. Men moved on and off the electoral register from one election to another. So if you lost your job, or you moved house, or you failed to pay your rates, you might drop off the electoral register for one election, but you'll be back on it again, potentially, at the next one. So although the sheer number of new male electors in 1918 looks very impressive, we've got 5.5 million more male electors than we did before, it would be wrong to say that they are all first-time voters or new voters. Many of them would almost certainly have voted at some point in the past. By contrast, of course, every single woman voting in 1918 was voting for the first time at a parliamentary election. So this is part of the justification for creating that age bar. Rather than flooding the electorate with new voters, you'll start with those who have most life experience and who at least have some kind of involvement with local politics. I don't think anybody really expected this arrangement to last. And 10 years later, of course, in 1928, that age bar is dropped. The franchise is equalised at the age of 21 for both men and women. But it had, I think, served a certain purpose over that period in terms of calming anxieties about women's suffrage and habituating male politicians to what a world of women's suffrage was going to look like. One question that we might want to consider is what difference the vote actually made. How is life different after 1918 to before? In some ways, of course, this is something that's extremely difficult to quantify. After 1928, the electoral system publicly acknowledges women as full and equal citizens, and the psychological consequences of that and the symbolic consequences of that are very difficult, I think, to calculate, but they're certainly significant. In more concrete terms, parties after 1918 are forced to target themselves at women voters. There are 8 million women on the electoral rolls after 1918. By 1928, there are more than 15 million, more than half the entire electorate. So parties have to orient their strategy much more towards women voters. So on one level, we see a shift in the kinds of things that Parliament does. You'll find on your handout a list of what is described at the time of women's legislation passed in the 1920s and 1930s. So we get a Married Women's Property Act, a Married Women's Maintenance Act, we get a reform of the divorce laws, there's a Guardianship of Infants Act, a reform of child adoption procedures, and so on and so on. Now, of course, the idea that things like child provision and adoption of children are women's issues is a reminder of how little cultural understandings of politics have changed in the period. But it does, I think, show Parliament struggling to reach out to a new cohort. And it is a change in the kinds of issues that governments are prioritising. And there's also a shift in the way that political parties talk about women. So this is a cartoon from the Daily Mirror, which at this time was a Conservative newspaper in 1922. It's called The Disguised Bolshe and the General Election. And here we have a sort of suspiciously socialist-looking figure called Labour Ski, with his dog Snatch, trying to confiscate the woman's cooking pot. with his male friends around him. And it's the sensible British housewife who beats him down the path with her saucepan. And the caption underneath is, "It will be the British housewife who deals the death blow to socialism in Britain." And we get in conservative propaganda between the wars a valorisation of women as, in a sense, the sort of the foundation of political sense, the Chancellor of the Exchequer of the home, someone who understands domestic economy, who understands the importance of the family in politics. So there's a much greater tone of respect used towards women in political rhetoric. Having said all this, there are, of course, limits to what changes in 1918. The House of Commons remained and remains an overwhelmingly male bastion. Until 1987, there were never more than 27 women MPs in the House of Commons. Women may have penetrated the electorate, but the internal structures of party politics remain much more impervious. To take just one example, if we look at the Carlton Club, which is, in a sense, traditionally the social nexus of conservative politics, the Carlton Club first admits women as full members in 2008, 3 years ago. They made an exception for Margaret Thatcher, but they did that by identifying her as an honorary man. No woman in Britain has ever been Chancellor of the Exchequer. It's only in the last 5 years that we've had a woman Foreign Secretary or a woman Home Secretary. So in that sense, the march of the women has some way to go. Perhaps the most immediate effect of these reform acts, though, was a new anxiety about the stability of British politics. Universal suffrage comes to Britain at an extremely precarious moment for parliamentary government. It's a time when democracies and semi-democracies across Europe are clearly extremely unstable. As we all know, the interwar period is not a good time for democracies. From the Russian Revolution to the rise of various fascist regimes, parliamentary government seemed to be morphing either into anarchy or into some kind of autocratic populism. And in that sense, the anxieties I talked about last week, the idea that democracy is intrinsically unstable, are as alive in the interwar period as they are in the 1860s. And in that respect, the first task of British politicians after 1918 is to stabilise the new democracy, to incorporate it into the structures of British politics. So Stanley Baldwin, probably the dominant figure of interwar politics, puts it like this: "My job, as party leader, my job is to try and educate a new democracy in a new world, to try and make them realise their responsibilities in their possession of power, and to keep the eternal verities before them." And it's easy, I think, to forget how long those anxieties last. Through the rise of extremism in the interwar period, to the challenge of Nazism during the war itself, to the Cold War challenge in the decades that follow. The first Prime Minister in British history who was born after the coming of universal suffrage was John Major in 1990. All of his predecessors, even Margaret Thatcher, can talk about democracy as something new, as something potentially experimental, something that has to be managed and nurtured. So if one of the themes of 19th century history is the slow transition to democracy, one of the themes of the 20th century, I think, is the taming of democracy, or a slow education for politicians and electorate alike in the working of democratic politics. And that, of course, is a theme for another series. That ends this series on the making of British democracy. Thank you very much for coming. If you have exams this summer, may I wish you the very best of luck. To the rest of you, I hope you enjoy the rest of term. Thank you for coming.